morning, everybody. Welcome to this ASAF meeting in our new boardroom. I hope you will enjoy the facilities as we do. We have also more space in the galleries, and they are well filled. A typical case of supply side economics.
Yes.
Oh man.
Yeah, we've got that here too. So I would suggest that we start with the first issue on the agenda, which is financial instruments with characteristics of equity. And I give the floor to Kala, who will tee off with a presentation.
Thanks, Hans. So I just want to take the opportunity to share the AOSSG Working Group members on financial instruments. Preliminary views with everyone here, and then open it up to the rest of the ASAF members to share their views on the discussion paper. So you see in slide three the member representatives who are on the Financial Instruments and Liabilities Working Group in AOSSG. So these views represent the views of these jurisdictions. And we do have a unified or consensus view on some of the matters in relation to the DP. So if I can start off, so generally the feedback, again, these are just preliminary views, that the classification principles and some of the terminologies used in the DP appears to be creating some new problems that weren't actually there before. For example, the use of the terms like entities available economic resources and amounts independent of the entities available economic resources. There was a view that these terms are quite confusing and appear to be quite circular in nature. And moving on from that, there was also some concern about the second leg of the principles, which is about the, again, amount independent of the economic resources and how that links in with a situation before, upon liquidation, because there was a question around if you are actually in a liquidation situation, whether the amount is independent of the entity's resources or not doesn't matter at that point. It's more about the priority of distribution. So whether some of these issues that the ISB is trying to deal with could be better dealt with through disclosures on liquidity and priority of claims. Mm-hmm. So that was the feedback on the terms and the principles. There was also views shared that perhaps practical issues like the NCI puts, foreign currency rights issue, have not dealt with as satisfactorily as could have been. For example, if I elaborate on the foreign currency rights issue, the jurisdictions felt that that was actually an exception that was working very well. And in the DP, there wasn't sufficient explanation as to how the problems that were there in 2009 when the exception was put in place have now been dealt with and why this exception is no longer needed. And in fact, some of the jurisdictions in AOSSG wanted a sort of a broader look on, you know, debts or rather instruments that are issued in foreign currency that would otherwise, if they were in functional currency, would look and feel and behave like equity instruments, but they are just merely issued in foreign currency because of the ability to raise funds. So they have to go to a foreign market. So should that then give rise to a different answer just because of that variable? So they would like the ISB to look more closely on that. There was also questions around how the principles developed in this DP would tie with what's currently in the revised conceptual framework. Perhaps the ISB could actually explain a bit more how the two projects will eventually align, if they are expected to align in terms of the definition. So these were some of the matters that were raised. Other issues raised were in relation to, I believe in some jurisdictions like Korea, they do have COCO bonds, which are the major issue there. So they are a big concern that the new principles may give rise to the classification being a liability. So wanted a bit more work done on that. People were generally supportive about the putable exception. However, they did acknowledge that that's a very narrow and possibly that was intended by the ISB to be that way. The region is going to do more research, or rather more outreach in this area, and that's outlined on slide 7, where Australia is going to do some outreach with accounting firms, banks, insurance companies, and corporates. And we have also heard in that jurisdiction about the co-ops and mutuals and how the putable exception might or might not work. Similarly, in China as well, and they also translated the DP into Chinese so that it can actually be better understood by their constituents. Korea is also planning an outreach in October to get more feedback, and the others as well, so yeah, which you can see on slide 7. So with that, I'll now open up to the rest of the ASAF members to share their views on this DP.
Andrew?
Thank you. Well, EFRAG's draft comment letter has been published. It was published at the end of August and open for comment until early December. So our provisional views are on record. I think overall, when we look at the points in your slide deck, then a lot of these points are flagged up in our draft comment letter. On the sort of terminology points and replacing potentially things like the fixed-for-fixed rule in IS 32 with the amount feature in the discussion paper. I think we have similar concerns as to whether, in the end, the risks of new confusion, new interpretive questions outweigh the potential benefits. But we do acknowledge that there are potential benefits in seeking a clearer articulation of what's, let's face it, is just a rule with no explanation of its underlying economic rationale. So I don't wouldn't want to dismiss potential advantages of this clear articulation, but like the OFSG, we are just about to embark on some quite extensive outreach and launch various surveys and try and get a better handle on the extent to which this new terminology or clear articulation might help or might cause additional confusion. You mentioned the rights issue exemption. That's also something we flag up. But I would say that it's kind of difficult at a principle level to justify why you get a equity treatment for a written foreign currency call if it's a rights issue. That's not if it's in a convertible bond. So I think the rights issue exemption was introduced with what you might see as rather unseemly haste a few years ago. And I think it's at least worth revisiting the question as to whether it's really justified. I'm not sure these are particularly commonplace in Europe, but they do happen. That's, again, something we'll try and get a fix on. More generally, you know, I think the discussion paper you can kind of divide up in various ways into the kind of classification proposals, into the presentation proposals, into the disclosure proposals, and potentially these different strands could be separated and some pursued and some not pursued. We certainly think that if you support the idea of a binary split, and I think on balance EFRAG does, you've got to recognise its limitations, so efforts to actually improve the information set around instruments that fall kind of on either side of the line, but close to the line, we would support, but we do have some questions around then some of the details, including the use of OCI for certain subsets of liabilities, whether trying to explore further exactly what we mean when we say certain effects in profit or loss are counterintuitive. Perhaps try and fine-tune the scope of the use of OCI if that's going to be supported at all. And on the attribution of total comprehensive income to subclasses of equity. I think this stage, I would say, we see the aim is laudable, but we're doing a lot of work to try and understand whether in the end the actual proposal or either of any of the three proposals actually are going to be effective in achieving the aim.
Linda.
Thanks. So we are early days in terms of assessing our views on this. We do have planned outreach in Canada. Tom and Kumar will be with us the week of October the 15th. And so we will have more definite views, but we have some preliminary views, some of which were formed because we did an education session on the DP for our board in the September meeting, because we thought that it was an important issue and wanted to make sure that those board members who don't have a lot of experience in this space were given, you know, enough background to help understand it. So to give you some perspective in terms of impact, basically looked at the industries that we think will have be significantly impacted and have to pay attention to this and be interested in it, between financial services, oil and gas, mining, utilities and pipelines, and technology and our venture, we think that it's likely going to affect potentially 60% of our market cap and 70% in terms of the number of entities. The other interesting piece here that I think we will end up discussing is that particularly in oil and gas and mining, there's a segment of those entities that still use U.S. GAAP. So there'll be, you know, a natural comparison in those industries to what is happening here versus what exists in U.S. GAAP. So we'll have to be mindful of that. So with that, the top issues that have come out of those discussions so far are looking at the foreign currencies, rights issue exception, and some concern that the removal of this could have a big implication on our constituents, because we have entities that have U.S. functional currency and raise debt in either U.S. or Canadian dollars. Early days, but our preliminary view is that could be an issue for us. We also support the retention of the putable exception. But we're a little concerned that some of the criteria might be a bit restrictive. So we're going to gather some instruments and examples on that just to test it out in terms of whether or not we think we have issues. In terms of the notion of the entity's available economic resources, anytime you refer to unrecognized assets and liabilities, it gets people's attention. And so I think that we just want to make sure that that concept is very well understood in terms of what you mean by that. And then there's some other specific items in terms of forward contracts, et cetera, which we hope we will bring out in the discussion next week or in October. So very supportive, but still very much looking at it from a preliminary perspective.
Andreas?
Thanks. Our comments will be very similar to the comments that came from the AOSG. Obviously, we are feeding into EFRAG's endorsement draft comment letter. Many of the comments that have been made, I won't reiterate, but we agree with them. One additional point that I would like to flag on the concepts, we believe that there may be a hidden assumption, and I've said that in one of the breakout sessions at WSS. You do have the amount and the timing criterion, but there is also one mention that every entity, or there should be in every entity at least one class that actually is treated as the most residual, and that should be treated as equity. So the question that I would have is, how does that tie into the timing and amount feature? So if you only have capital outstanding that misses on one or both of the criteria, and none of that class actually qualifies for the putable exception, what does that then mean? Is there, by definition, does there have to be another class of equity participating? And if so, I would advise you to actually investigate into that and spell that out clearly. More On the messaging aspect, we have received some initial feedback in our technical committee that was based on the experiences made with IFRS 15 in particular, where many companies see themselves as having had to go through the entire inventory of contracts for a lot of amount and effort, only to see that the impact of that was really marginal. And there is a fear that something similar might appear with this approach, where there is a stated intention, we don't want to incur any change, we just want to make it clearer, yes, by articulating the new concept, you're actually force people, intentionally or unintentionally, to actually review all the contracts. And so people are starting questioning, is it really worth the effort if the intention is not to see any fundamental changes, to then make us review all the contracts? So I think anything that the board could do in order to make clearer which types of instruments you would not need to actually reassess, because the outcome would be clear, would help, because then entities could just put these aside and really concentrate on those areas where really you might be seeing change, and that would be one way of actually addressing that concern.
Lastly, our consultations inside the standard set are still ongoing, but we will have a outreach event jointly with EFRAG in November, and we hope to see clearer by then.
Alexander.
Our outreach is scheduled to happen next Monday, so everything I'm saying here is quite preliminary. But I would like to have some more clarification on the point that is raised here about the amount independent of entities available economic resources are not independent, because in the region, the most common in apart from ordinary shares are preferred shares, the preferred shares that pay dividends, which is generally a fixed amount of the accounting period net income. So generally, it's a preferred share, so there is 25% of net income that's paid as dividends. This is a general instrument. So it's a from the start, it's a little bit confusing. So this is generally treated as equity in the region. But now you have some bonds that say, well, it's a perpetual bond that pays, you only have to pay the coupon on the bond, which is 8%, 7%. If the firm has earnings, has a positive accounting earnings in that in the specific period. Some people say, well, that's pretty much a preferred share because it pays 8%, and only if you have earnings. And then the point of cumulative comes into place. So then it's independent or not independent of the entity's economic resource has a timing feature, because maybe it is dependent at the moment, but as it is cumulative, it's not going to be dependent on the future. So I think some clarification, as my the preliminary discussion that I have, should be interesting on those instruments. And then there is another deviation from this basic situation. This is the cocoa bonds. Then you can stop paying dividends when something bad happens. For example, company goes to regulatory capital below a certain level. So as far as my jurisdiction is concerned, I believe those are the two issues that are still confusing. My point here is some variation of Andreas is mentioned. I don't know if this is helping to clarify those two situations. I believe that people are pretty much in the same kind of question that they are before. So if something on the standard would help to clarify those situations, that's going to be very, very helpful for example, this preferred share, the discussions were endless, and at some point they have to decide, but we were very insecure about how to treat that under IAS 32. So that's a bit of the point.
Yukio.
Thanks, Hans. We understand that there are both conceptual and application issues in this area, and appreciate the ISB's effort to address such issues. However, we are concerned with how the project is proceeding. I'd like to summarize these concerns in 3 points. The first point is about the proposed classification principles in the DP. We think that combining the two features is complex and question how these principles provide benefit to stakeholders. In particular, regarding the timing feature, the DP seems to give excessive weight to the existing distinction, and this may obscure how the feature relates to the user's need to assess funding liquidity. Considering that there could be various timing for when the claim requires a transfer of economic resources, the information provided by focusing only on timing of liquidation may be too limited. In addition, the DP proposes some exceptions to the proposed classification principles, such as the retention of the exception for the putable instrument in IS 32. This may be the impression that the proposed principles are not effective in explaining the classification outcomes. The second point is about the use of OCI to income and expenses arising from the certain financial liabilities. We are concerned that this proposal would expand the use of OCI to a new type of income and expenses. In addition, we are concerned about non-recycling of the amount presented in OCI because this seems inconsistent with the statement of the conceptual framework that income and expenses included in OCI in one period are in principle reclassified to profit or loss in the future period. We think that the cumulative amounts of profit or loss over time need to be as complete as possible. The third point is about the attribution of total comprehensive income to each equity instrument. We are not convinced with the benefit of such attribution, in particular for derivative equity instruments. For example, anomaly may arise from remeasuring the derivative equity instrument at fair value because different measurement attributes are applied to different assets and liabilities. In addition, some stakeholders are concerned with potential loss of information if the existing line items such as retained earnings would not be prevented. In summary, we think that the benefits of project may not outweigh the resources required to develop the proposal further. As noted in the conceptual framework, information about the entity's financial performance helps users to understand the return the entity has produced on the economic resources and predict the entity's future returns on its economic resources. Based on this, this understanding, what is more important is to identify who the holders of equity claims are, which is referred in referred to in the definition of income and expenses. The discussion in the DP seems to lack such a perspective. Accordingly, we'd like to ask the ISB to consider this issue from such a perspective.
Chris?
Thanks, Hans. So just a general observation, it seems like the messaging of why you're doing this project is actually not cut through with people. So I had several conversations with people trying to explain that it's meant to be establishing some principles for IS 32 and helping trying to future-proof things, but that just doesn't really seem to be getting any traction. So I think whatever you can do to actually help get people a bit more focused on that aspect, I think would be useful. Just secondly, then, picking up on some of the specific issues, I think the concerns in Australia that we've heard so far about the proposals are that there's a lot of change that they don't really understand the benefits of, and they don't feel like that the practical issues that they have are actually being addressed by these proposals. So the three things that we've had highlighted to us so far are the options over options, so which they call piggyback options, step-up bonds, and things that have anti-dilutive measures, protective measures in them. They just don't feel that these proposals are actually addressing those, and that seems to be some of their key concerns. The other interesting thing which we need to follow up further, we do have a very active user on our panel, and his comments were that in practice, he's actually doing, particularly with hybrid instruments, he's really separating out the debt and equity components from a valuation perspective. So I do wonder whether there is actually some merit in rethinking that as well.
It seems to be the feedback is a bit ambivalent. On the one hand, I hear you don't change much, so why don't you just leave it alone? But on the other hand, there are a lot of issues that people want to be addressed. Cheers. Sue.
So one of the points I wanted to make is, I think, one that Chris started off with, which is that maybe we've done ourselves a little bit of a disservice in terms of the way that we've presented the discussion paper, because I think it is the case that in many, if not most cases, the classification outcomes are probably the same. So the reaction from many is probably, why put me through all of this pain when there's going to be no difference in outcome, which is a fair question. But I think we need to also remember that there's been a number of questions that have come to the Interpretations Committee where, even though committee members may have been pretty confident of what the requirements in 32 were, actually getting that to the stage that the market agreed with that through the comment process, etc., was extremely difficult because we just didn't have the foundations in 32 to explain why that was the outcome. And I think a couple of things I think we're trying to do with what's in this document, even where we don't change outcomes, is to give us the underpinnings that would mean that even where there's no change from what I think should be the case today, we can actually get that consistent application. But also the point that Chris made, which is to future-proof it, because if there's any area of accounting where we constantly have to deal with change, it's financial engineering. And there'll be instruments, you know, designed in the next few years that we haven't even thought of yet, and we hope that if we have these ideas to build on, then our ability to get answers to those questions for people to understand and to apply consistently in the future would be better. So, and we probably haven't communicated that as well as we could. So I think, and then just to add on a couple of requests, I guess, because I think this is the initial feedback that you are giving us, so maybe some suggestions of things that would help me when we're doing re-deliberations in terms of the feedback from ASAF members. What we tried to do in the DP is to start off with these two ideas of timing and amount and to explain why we thought they were useful for investors. And the problem with financial instruments accounting is we often have a tendency to look at particular instruments and say, how's that classified? Yes, I like that. No, I don't like that. And to respond that way. I think it would be really helpful for us to understand whether people agree with those two basic ideas that we built from. And then when you look at whether or not the outcomes are what you like, to tie back to whether that means there's something wrong with the ideas, because that would help us with this idea of building from the foundations. So maybe that would be one suggestion. Also, obviously, it's really important for us to understand how big the effects are. Certainly based on, I've only done a little bit of outreach so far, I'm going to do a lot more in the next few weeks, but there's probably more instruments changing classification than I had anticipated when the document went out, and that's really important for us to know. But I think the second thing we need to understand is, if you agree with those two starting pieces that we had, are those the wrong outcomes or not, or is that an appropriate consequence of what we're proposing? So that it's interesting to know there's a change, because we need to then determine whether or not there's enough benefit to justify that change, but do we actually think that that's the wrong change or not, given where we started, and does that tell us something about our starting point? So I'd encourage you to look at that. Another thing that's coming up quite a lot in around this table, but also in outreach that I've heard about, is the effect of quite a big change from 32, which is the focus on the effects in liquidation. Mm. So the fact that today you can have a perpetual instrument and if you can defer payments indefinitely until liquidation, then that's equity, and we're proposing that to be a change. That, I think, is having much more of a potential effect on classification than I had anticipated when the document went out. Now, I think the gut reaction for us at the table probably in response to that is, well, that's easy to fix. We should just change the amount feature to say ignore liquidation, just like 32, and it works, and we're all happy and fine. There's not too much change in practice. But I guess one thing for you guys to think about to help us from a standard-setting perspective is one of the sort of intangible benefits, if you like, of that liquidation focus was that we felt that it helped us a lot with the economic compulsion stance in 32, which is retained in the standard. The fact that we say, what are you required to do as opposed to what do you expect the outcome to be? By focusing on liquidation, the number of instruments which are structured to be debt-like in terms of their marketing, pricing, etc., they achieve that by having this focus on things that only happen in liquidation. That would have helped us address the classification of a lot of things where economic compulsion isn't introduced. If we take that liquidation focus back out again, we've got a big economic compulsion question again that gets opened up that we wouldn't have addressed in the DP. So if you write to us and say, take out liquidation, I'd love you to say, and instead think about doing this to address economic compulsion. And the last point I'd make, Andreas touched on transition, and I think that's really important, and I think that we're coming to the market when people are just getting through 9, 15, 16 transition and how difficult that can be in everybody's mind. And I'd hate the DP to die because people are like, oh, my God, that was such hard work, I don't want to have to do that again, because we do ultimately want to improve financial reporting. I think maybe we should think creatively about, well, so what's the ultimate outcome? Do we think that is a good ultimate place to be? And then maybe if we wanted to, we could, if we decided that was the place we wanted to end up, we could maybe think about things to do during transition that would make it easier. So, for example, unless you've got an instrument with particular characteristics that we know are going to change, perhaps you don't have to worry until you issue new instruments or something like that. So I'm making it up on the fly, but I would hate transition to be the barrier to an ultimate improvement in financial reporting.
Kumar?
No, just to come in from where Sue left off, Andreas, fully appreciate that's a messaging. Maybe given our drafting and how careful we have to be, it was a bit subtle. We have given that indication in the DP that the board will consider. Absolutely fair point. And that was also, I've been doing a bit of outreach, and that's absolutely the point coming up. And we are cognizant that there's no point for people. And some of these contracts, as you can imagine, are pretty old. They're equity. So absolutely cognizant. On the FX, one thing would be very useful, what I came out from when I was talking to the bankers and everything, is that is maybe we need to do this much better, is that they need to understand that it is coupled with a separate presentation requirement. So the question which I asked them and which did come up, and they said, okay, will we get it? So that's the question which is coming up. So as I phrased it before, the question which I'm trying to get, is it a classification issue or a performance issue? Because those are the two things, and they're different things. So would be good to get some idea when they're coming. Do you think even if, I think the concern is coming that they might not get the separate presentation in the way we have drafted it. So that would be useful for us to know as well, very useful when we go through to see whether that acts as a solution or not.
Russ.
Thank you. I would encourage you to continue working through a solution here. In the U.S., we have not done outreach on your discussion paper because we're working on a very similar project. But in the U.S., I believe that distinguishing between liabilities and equity is the least understood aspect of U.S. GAAP. I base this on a number of restatements, the amount of cost that goes into determining the appropriate accounting, and the amount of angst and uncertainty when the preparer and the auditor think they've arrived at a conclusion. And I think some of that also continues in IFRS. So I would encourage you to try to come up with something to try to make this more understandable. We've done a substantial amount of outreach to investors that are focusing on U.S. GAAP. And I think that they would probably, if I'd asked them about IFRS, they'd say the same thing. What they've said almost uniformly is, they want to focus on disclosures. They want to know what are the terms of the instrument so they can make their own decisions. They have focused on also a presentation.
And they do not, and as an accountant, I do not understand this, but my fellow board member who's an investor says they're absolutely right, is they do not want a bifurcation of convertible debt. They don't seem to like separating things that are not separable. And we can get into more details as to why that's the case. In the U.S., we have a difference of opinion at the FASB as to what is the best solution to make this more understandable. Some board members, including myself, believe we should do targeted changes. We like the fix-for-fix philosophy. We call it indexation and settlement, but we like the fix-for-fix philosophy. We just think that over the years, the EITF and the board have written too many examples, some of which relate to fact patterns that exist and some of which relate to fact patterns that I don't think exist. But and what has happened is a typical expert in this area goes through every single example and tries to find the example that most closely relates to their fact pattern without thinking about the underlying philosophy of what this is trying to depict. And so I would personally like to make targeted changes and get rid of most of those examples so there's a consistent philosophy. And then protect that perhaps angst around the classification with an increased amount in disclosures. Other board members of the FASB believe that we should have all of these should be accounted for the same manner, which would be a remeasurement, and perhaps take some of the remeasurements outside of performance and into comprehensive income. So that's what we're studying. So far, the investor approach that we've talked about input is really been about trying to make the current model work with presentation and not remeasure. But again, I do believe, and I would highly encourage you to continue working so that we can reduce the angst. And when I think about that, I think about the typical accountant out there, not the Big Four technical expert. It's the typical accountant that doesn't deal with this every day. They need to be able to pick it up and have some reasonable amount of certainty that they can get it right. And right now, I just don't think that they have that.
You were talking about your preference for targeted improvements.
Yeah.
But would you also be working on trying to strengthen the underlying principles, or is that something that you want to leave alone?
No. So in the U.S., if you're a targeted improvement person, what you're focused on is, and what we're doing is we're bringing in the technical experts and saying, can we soften some of the indexation and settlement language in the U.S.? Right now, the way we say it's a derivative unless it's indexed to and settled in your own equity. And then there's all these rules about what that means, right? Nilly probably dealt with that every day when she in her prior job, and those rules are not intuitive. So, for example, is that a good way to?
That's another statement.
Is that a politically correct way of saying that?
Yeah? No, politically incorrect. Okay. Yeah.
they
emphatic.
Yeah. And so I think a typical accountant would not believe that some of the rules that we have today are logical. And so we're trying to soften that to make it so that it is more logical, but still within the concept of indexation and settlement. And so I think if we're successful, what we'll have is, I'm hopeful, a simplification and a better understood approach to distinguishing this. Still based on the fix for fix philosophy that is in IFRS.
Sorry,
it's not intuitive at all.
Harry,
I think a few notes scattered on both the feedback I've heard over the last few days of meetings, and some reactions to us in the papers and what we're hearing today. First of all, in terms of terminology and messaging, I think we've got some good advice for the future in terms of thinking harder about how we present things. And I think part of it for the outreach I'll be doing, it's probably starting out and saying, this is a discussion paper. What is the point? You know, what is the purpose of a discussion paper? And I'm saying this to maybe encourage you to approach further outreach that you're doing in the same way. And it's to set out the principles that we're thinking of and have a discussion of the pros and cons and you know what the consequences would be. So I think that kind of discussion appears more far-reaching than it maybe you know than it is intended to be, because it is a discussion paper. If you think back to our shared recent experience of the conceptual framework, when people picked up, let's say, the discussion paper or the exposure draft, and then they start trying to solve accounting problems from that, yes, it's a good exercise to test it, but it does kind of kick up more dust than is the intention or the actual effect. So I think putting it in the context of this is a discussion paper, the board is exploring whether this is the right direction to pursue standard setting rather than this is the final word and this is how it will be phrased is important. And that's just a request for help with messaging, and we'll take the point about how we do it in the future. A couple of other points that I've heard of as sensitivity points that maybe ask you to get some more information. One is the separate presentation in OCI, and I've heard some pros and I've heard some cons, and I think the example that makes it come alive for me, not being a financial instruments geek, not looking in particular at anybody in a green jacket, is NCI puts. I think everybody, Russ's typical accountant says, I get it if somebody can knock on your door and say, write me a check for the fair value of these shares that you have a liability. So there's less, there's not really a concern about classifying them as liabilities, but the remeasurement is what has always tripped up, all discussions at the Interpretations Committee and elsewhere. Yes, they have to be remeasured to the current put amount, but where does that remeasurement get presented? And some people see it as counterintuitive, some don't, because, you've made a promise and this is what it's tied to. And you're paying, if the sub is doing well, you're paying more and more. You're on the hook for more and more, and that should be in P&L. Other people say, how is this different from a treasury share transaction? And, when the treasury share transaction gets recorded in equity. So the separate presentation is it is kind of in between in the sense of it's not an equity transaction directly in equity, but it is segregated from performance. So I think I'd really appreciate all of you in your outreach when you get to that point about separate presentation, making people focus on putable non-controlling interest. And I don't think there's dispute about it's a liability. I think when you have a liability, you have to remeasure it to the claim amount. Think about that in contrast with the treasury share. And it would be very helpful to get feedback, not just kind of the generic why separate presentation. That's just for that piece, because there's several items, and Kumar, I'm sure, can rattle them off, that get separate presentation. But that's the one in terms of the concept that really anchors it, at least for me. And then a third question, this is me really dabbling where I don't have enough background, but some of the feedback that I heard last week included the question of if you have a financial institution, should we be focusing on information on liquidation, or should we be looking instead on some kind of forced recapitalization event as the most important, how do you participate? And if people are saying, I'd rather have the information on recap, regulator forced recap, my question is whether it's clear enough what would happen for that to be a basis of presenting information about what would happen on recapitalization. Has it all become bedded down enough you can say, okay, in recapitalization, here's what would happen and here's what the claims would be? Or are you speculating, well, it's likely they'd do this, or if it was like that, and if so, and if it's more like the latter, then while reorganization, recapitalization could be quite interesting information, I'm not sure that it would provide enough of a basis for even disclosure. So that's, I think it's a very good point about what users might be more interested in, because that's an event that's likely to come before liquidation, but is it enough of a basis, clear enough basis for, I'm not even getting into the classification principles, I'm getting into, let's say, the priority in liquidation disclosures. So those are several points feeding back that I've picked up from outreach messaging to date.
Thanks. So to follow up briefly on I think Sue and also Mary's comment around the role of liquidation and the amount feature, and I think Sue suggested this is a sort of partial solution to concerns around economic compulsion. which I think I get. But so my question is, isn't the concern about economic compulsion equally prevalent for a non-cumulative preference share or any instrument where the coupons are discretionary, irrespective of whether they kind of roll up and have to be settled on liquidation? And actually, Mary, on the OCI and what's intuitive and what's counterintuitive, that's rather in the kind of eyes of the intuitor, so it's inherited. But I don't think it's enough to say something is counterintuitive to present gains and losses in P&L because the liability increases when the company does well. The same would apply to all kinds of performance-related compensation, for example. I don't think we'd extend the argument to that. A gross settled NCI put is, from the holder's point of view, is a fair value exchange on settlement. But because conceptually your own equity is not an asset for the issuer, then the accounting kind of creates the horns of a dilemma for us. But I would distinguish probably between a gross settled NCI put and, for example, a net cash settled NCI put, where all that's going to happen on settlement is a cash payment to the holder, and there is no actual exchange. But I think if I understand the discussion paper well, and perhaps I don't, then you get the same OCI treatment for a gross settled and a net cash settled put.
No, you wouldn't.
You won't.
It's for the gross physically share settled is where the thing is. Net share settled, cash settled will be not within the gross up.
No, that's helpful.
Well, actually, Kumar, could I just, Andrew, were your questions in the context of classification as liability versus equity, or were they in the context of, sorry for the NCIs, the separate presentation? You said you'd make a distinction. Are you saying classification that you think gross share settled is not a liability? That gross settled putable NCI is not a liability?
I was commenting more on the presentation within OCI, though we do in our draft comment letter suggest you might want to look again at the question of whether all derivatives should be at fair value through profit or loss, but I would say that's a minority view among commentators so far from what we're hearing in Europe. Given that we're not asking for radical change, that seems to be crossing the line into radicalism.
Right, but I'm still trying to get to that all derivatives, fair value P&L, I assume that you're questioning through P&L versus fair value is the measurement basis. What I'm getting back to is your question. When you say you'd make a distinction between certain types of putable NCI,
yes,
depending on the settlement, are you saying there should be a line that's a difference about liability versus equity classification, or is it just about presentation?
I thought it was a gross up.
Presentation. Because on the basis that a gross settled put at fair value is economically a fair value exchange.
And, okay. I couldn't tell, and I wanted to make sure.
Just quickly, Andrew, fully appreciate the liquidation focus. The other thing which we need to understand that better, because one of the things that's coming up because of the focus is that there are certain resolution mechanisms which are in place, we need to consider what is that. Is it a liquidation or not? Now, coming to your point about cumulative and non-cumulative and how it's looking at economic compulsion side of things, remember, even for a non-cumulative, we say the principal amount, the PV is zero, but it's a liability which is measured at zero because you bring it back. Most of these bonds, these so-called perpetuals, have a call feature. That's where the thing comes in. It's an issuer call, which will be priced to that, and that's where the pricing comes in. So where the issue comes in, and which Sue was referring to, is that if you have, as per your expectation, an outflow in 10 years, then under 9, that will become a liability. So that's what we were trying to capture. Mm-hmm. Understand the consequences, but so that's where the mirroring happens. So that's the point, I think, which Sue also made, is that fully appreciate. We will look at that, but let us know how do we address this, because that's what we were trying to get
to. That's helpful.
Well.
The liability measured at zero. Pretty much excitement.
Yes, but it does when you're...
But it will when you get to IFRS 9 and then you've got to look at your expected cash flows, because you expect to call it at year 10, it won't be zero.
That's when it picks up, because I'm pushing it into 9 and that's when it picks up. So have a think about that one. That's what we were trying to get to.
Russ?
So this
this dialogue between Mary and Andrew. We have thought about should we create a third category and say some of these are fair value through net income, some are fair value through OCI, and some aren't remeasured. And some board members like that. I personally don't, because I think that right now there's very difficulty in determining which line you're in, fair value net income or not. And by creating a third category, I'm afraid we'll just create more questions. But the dialogue about gross settled, net settled, NCIs, we get that. Other accountants don't. Kumar talks about a call does this. And really, to me, what it's about is make it so the line's easy to do. But really, the information I think investors need is the disclosures. What I've learned from my dialogue with investors is they don't understand the nuances of the distinction. And I don't think a typical investor would understand or know gross settlement versus net settlement makes. And we're not talking about a subtle distinction. We're talking about a substantial distinction on day one and throughout. And what they really want is the disclosures. That said, I was just going to mention one thing that we've done in the past on transition type things like this to make it easier is we have historically made the transition prospective for all new contracts or modified existing contracts. And our philosophy has been as well, the company's going to decide if they want to modify it or not. It's kind of a choice if you want to incur the cost to change. Just something, if I would hope that transition doesn't cause a problem for making progress. There should be an easy way to do that.
On your point on, you know, it's geek speak when we get into, you know, net settled, gross settled, and it is to a certain extent, but if the investors are told that the difference between the two is that in one case you've got an obligation to write a check for the full amount of your non-controlling interest, that's very different to writing a check for, you know, the difference between a strike and value.
It is, in the disclosure, the terms would tell them that. And so the key question is, so they would know if you're obligated to do the gross or net in the disclosures. The key question, I think, to investors is should it actually change the potential performance? Should it change the classification and the categories? Or should we say, just make sure the investor is aware that of the terms of the contract?
Doc?
Thank you. Just inspired by Mary's comment, this is the discussion paper. And I was also struck by the question in the this slide, page 4, third line says, changes to classification outcomes that are well understood have been made without providing enough explanation as to why different outcome are better. Actually, it is a very good question. And I think there are lots of people saying that, as an example, rights issue. So we are going to change the practice of rights issue. So current account treatment for rights issue is well understood. Why do we have to change? I could agree that. But I was an IFRIC member when we discussed the rights issue. And at that time, we noticed a variety of similar type of financial instrument. And then in the end, we decided not to address the fundamental rethinking of idea of classification, but leave it to the FIES project. But instead, we just focused on very narrow scope treatment for rights issue. In this sense, in my understanding, rights issue was given a little bit of privilege compared to other similar financial instruments. So what we are going to discuss in the discussion paper, rather than having a rule-based specific treatment for some specific financial instrument, but we provide a rather simpler principle. So the discussion paper we need to discuss is having a kind of principle would improve the future standard setting work or not. In such a kind of discussion, it is what we are expecting.
Mm-hmm. Alexander?
You mentioned that maybe the comments are going in different directions here. Just maybe one of the reasons of that discrepancy is that I strongly agree with Russ that this is maybe one, or if it's not the topic, one of the topics where the gap, the knowledge gap between the expert and the common accountant is bigger, because this transaction, the first one, they are complicated and they are not, they don't happen every day. So you do it, and 2 years later you come back to it. So you don't create a the common Joe here doesn't get more experience of time. So maybe we could err here in the side of access and give you more examples on the standard, because I believe that some jurisdictions the main element is still very unclear. The second one, I agree also with the question of disclosures, because solution, maybe what Sue mentioned, that new instruments are coming all the time, is the answer to that, in my view, is disclosure, because as some people, especially users here, I don't think they understand the difference, the complexities, and even if they understand, they may not agree with that difference for covenant perspectives and so on and so forth. So I believe the disclosure component of that should be more granular than is generally the case on principle-based standards. So it should get more granular in that. I think that case grants an exception. Yeah.
Andreas?
Thank you. Coming back to NCI, issue of recapitalization, as Mary phrased it, I think one area where I believe more work needs to be done is on contingencies. And I mean, the contingency that we currently have, a liquidation, I think is an odd one, because we are set to actually prepare financial statements on a going concern hypothesis. So why am I now worried in looking at something that actually is contingent, being a liquidation? But I think there is an overarching question, really. Do you apply a look-through approach? So taking your example of NCI puts you, said, well, I entered into an obligation to pay. I don't think that's the case. I entered into a promise to eventually enter into an obligation. And I think that contingency is not really reflected. So if we treat all options as exercised at the day of issuance, that might give me a completely different outcome, as opposed to I have entered into an agreement, I account for that agreement, but I don't account for all the consequences out of that agreement up until it becomes clear. Now, that would, if you follow down that approach, that would lead you to reclassification, but reclassification not by changing contracts, but reclassification by change of events and circumstances. And that is probably something where you don't know whether you have looked into this or not, but that might inform you as to how you go about this issue of... what's that? Contingency, if you do make, if you can decide whether you're to redeem or not to redeem the step-up bonds. Thank you. Economic compulsion. I was looking for that. But, all right. Because that equally isn't a contingency. So the question is, do you just peek through and say, well, by all means, that will happen or will not happen? And I think the answers that we are currently deriving at are different. So on contingent and on economic compulsion, you're actually saying, no, you don't look through, because by all means, I mean, that instrument at the end will be repaid at some stage. I just don't know when. Is there an obligation? No, there is not. So therefore, I just treat it as for now as if it was outstanding for all the time. On derivatives, I think we are taking a different route. We are taking them as exercised already. And I think what you could do, for instance, if you approach the NCI put issue, up until that put has been exercised, you account for the put and record all the fair value changes, but you don't apply any change to the shares on which the put has been written, because so far the instruments are outstanding, they participate in all the profit distribution that's existing there. So why would you then actually classify them at that day as a liability? That would give you an odd outcome. And I think that is one piece where we struggle when we run through the examples, really, that you created, where you issue a put, but that put is at the end not exercised. So you do all sorts of bookings and debits and credits, but you have to reverse at the end. And the question is, what actually has changed to the underlying instrument? Not the put, but the underlying instrument. So I think... dealing with contingencies is a broader issue that I
think more work needs to be done. NCI issue puts is certainly one issue, recapitalization and liquidation is another one, but also economic compulsion is a contingency.
Sure.
And the points you raise, of course, are all valid points and valid views, and I think at least some of them we did discuss when we were deliberating, but I guess just to make a couple of observations perhaps to think about when you're responding to us, because it would be helpful. So I think, at the risk of making an accounting joke in bad taste, the discussion paper is quite prudent in the sense of how it hunts for liabilities. And so, for example, in the case of the puts over shares, even though they may not be exercised, we sort of say, but hang on, you know, these aren't the same as normal equity because you've got no, you know, suddenly somebody can come up and make you write a check. And we're so, we think that's so important, I guess, in terms of our thinking in the DP. We think that should get priority and therefore that causes the gross accounting. But obviously that's one view of the world. It's not the only view of the world, but I think that was our logic. Mm-hmm. And you're exactly, you're perfectly right, and I think we did discuss this when we looked at sort of the contingent outcome stuff. We've gone with a view of if you've got an obligation, don't look at the likelihood of exercise, just look at the obligation and say it might happen. Therefore, again, let's be prudent, hunt for liabilities, and we do that. The alternative view would be to say, okay, let's reassess the likelihood of these events happening. And some people would argue that's more economic. Probably, arguably, if you looked at the measurement of the instruments in the market, that's probably how the market would value those instruments. But I think if you suggest that to us, we'll need to be convinced about the benefits of the burden of having to reassess and having flip-flops and classification and the complexity from an accounting perspective that comes with that. And also, again, with my prudent hat on, the risk that suddenly something wasn't likely and suddenly it becomes likely and all of a sudden this thing that you thought was equity-like turns into a liability and whether that's in the best interests of investors. The other point you make on economic compulsion, and this is the one that for me is always the hardest one, is what do you do in terms of likelihood of payments being made? Because if we could somehow focus in on that, it would take a lot of pressure out of the black and white of the classification. And the one for me that always is the most difficult to think about is, you know, the blue chip ordinary share where everybody expects them to pay dividends all of the time. If it's based on expectations, why has that not become a liability? And where do we draw the line? And that's the one for me that is just so difficult.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just to make it clear, I wasn't arguing in favour of the former FASB's idea, the reassess suspected outcomes approach. So I wasn't arguing in favour of doing stochastic modelling year after year. I think for most of these contingencies, these are binary events.
Yeah.
And they either occur or they don't occur. The question is, as of when do you want to take note of that? And I think I would probably, in that regard, be considering a less prudent approach and saying you account for it as of when it happens and you deal with the rest by disclosures, actually informing the investor so they have the information available that something may be cooking.
Yeah. I just think that for us, just being candid, to allow somebody to have something on the balance sheet as equity and to not have to think about it again until some event happens and suddenly it becomes a liability. But by the way, it was in note 57, is going to be very hard for us to defend.
And I'll be writing OPETs in the FT again to explain
that. But isn't Andres' like,
if
point...
If people don't like it, then they can... If we write prudent standard, then they might also just choose prudent products.
But is there any threshold in your mind about the likelihood of the contingency? That's what causes the illogical philosophy in the U.S. is any contingency, even very, very remote, could cause a problem. That's why people miss it, because the clause is put in, they don't realize it's in, the CFO, the CEO don't view it as significant at all. And so...
Until it is.
But the problem is that... On day one, they don't view it. So my view is if you're going to do that, just make them all liabilities. Make it easy. So in other words, don't play the game of, well, it's equity as long as you meet the 4,800 pages of rules. If you're gonna do something that's based on these illogical contingencies that are very, very remote, just make them all liabilities.
The problem was we would have if we'd been in 2005. And the banks were issuing these instruments that things didn't happen until the crisis happened, where would we have ended up?
But you could reassess every period and say, if it's more than remote...
The challenge is it would have almost happened overnight. and would we have served well? But yeah, you're right. At the moment, the short answer to your question is at the moment, as long as it's not, as long as it has substance and it's not just ridiculous, it gets counted.
And Ross, fully appreciate. What happens is the bonds that have been mentioned were the step-up bonds. Those were absolutely the option unless and until you do a multiple, which was ridiculous.
Right.
But actually, during the crisis, that ridiculous amount kicked in, and those clauses brought in and had a lot of teeth.
Mm.
So that's where the challenge comes in, and that changed quite quickly.
That's a fair question.
Mm-hmm. Patrick?
Well, just a quick reaction to what Andrea said. I think I would be roughly aligned with his line of thought, because I think that a triggering event, of course, if it's lost somewhere in the notes, is difficult for people to realize that there is a contingency and the likelihood of the contingency. And therefore, that brings the idea of having something on the face of the balance sheet, which is, of course, maybe distinguishing between the ones that are with a real contingency attached to it and the ones that are not. I mean, the plain vanilla products are easier to understand. The contingent ones, either you go to the notes, but then you have to drill down and you come to the story of the expert that is doing it, that nobody else is doing it, or you want to flag out that there is a, you know, it's just a comparison. We're working on ICOs, and when you have a look at the white papers that are produced, there are so many contingencies and disclaimers that how do you account for it? So either it's information, or it's information in the notes, or information on the face of the balance sheet. Maybe a category. It's not a third category per se, but it's an indication. I think it's the best way to put, because I think classifying everything as a liability, because there is an element of contingency, is going too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair point.
I'd forgotten one request in terms of outreach and things to be attuned to and maybe ask about. You know, several, I think Yukio was one, raised concerns, reported concerns about attribution and you know, whether the cost benefit is there. I ask that when you're doing outreach about attribution, that you understand where the resistance is coming, because I've heard mixed views that people want the attribution to the non-derivative, non-NCI piece. So, you know, what are the participating rights of preferreds, for example? But they don't, you know, they see the complexity that comes from the attribution to the derivative piece of equity as being the one that, the part that leads them to say, does it pass cost benefit? So just in terms of understanding, what, you know, if a single message of attribution fails cost benefit, but getting some nuance into that about which piece of the attribution is it? I'm not worried about which method as much, but, you know, what piece of it, and do they see value, and can it be answered by disclosure alone in terms of the derivative, non-derivative piece?
Okay. I think this was a very useful discussion.
Thank you.
Gave us good pointers for future outreach. Okay, we go to the...